This is New Hampshire Public Radio News. It's now 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. Today in The Exchange, a two-part show. First, the impact of this huge storm we're seeing in New England. Later in the hour, some exciting new research about bats and their amazing immune systems, what this might teach us about human disease. But let's start with the weather and hear from you. What have you seen in your area? How has this storm so far affected you? The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And for the first half of the show today, we'll talk with a number of people who are keeping a very close eye on this storm. Joining us now from the Seacoast, where we hear that the storm has especially hit hard, is Beth Dinan. She's a reporter for Seacoast Online. She's in Portsmouth right now covering this storm. And Beth, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, what's the storm look like right now at the Seacoast?
I'd say it's exactly as predicted. It's coming down fast and it's blowing around in high winds. And you'll see in some places the snow has drifted as much as 4 or 5 feet. And in other places you might have under a foot. So there are those kinds of challenges.
Yeah, you've got that extra wind gusts coming off of the ocean, right?
Correct.
So
I spoke with the Public Works Director, who said as soon as they're clearing roads, it's filling back in. But, you know, they're doing the best to prioritize to keep police stations and fire stations cleared out. And the secondary roads are secondary priorities.
Right. And I was going to ask you that, Beth. What has been the effect on the local roads, not just from the incredible snow and the wind that you talked about, but also storm surges, strong waves and so forth?
We've heard about surges down in the Hampton area, nothing in Portsmouth. But one thing that's keeping Portsmouth police busy this morning is people that didn't heed the warning not to park on the street. So they are towing a bunch of cars this morning.
Oh, wow. Okay. And power outages, Beth, again, given especially the wind.
Nothing here yet. I do have an interesting event that's scheduled for today in Portsmouth at 1 o'clock. There's an online group that's planning a snowball fight at 1 o'clock, and they're saying it'll be in Market Square. And so far, there's over a couple hundred people signed up to attend. And the Public Works Director has told me he doesn't want them in Market Square because visibility is so poor; someone could get hurt. And he's hoping they'll reorganize in another place in the city.
Well, or maybe just wait until the storm passes, right?
Well, it doesn't look like it's going to happen that way. It's followed by beer, so it might be an excuse to meet for beer.
Anything else, Beth, that you want folks in other parts of the state to know about what is specifically happening at the Seacoast? Again, we do hear that, you know, your part of the state is being especially hard hit.
The cars, people that are going out are getting stuck. So I think it is wise to stay home and, you know, wait it out.
Okay. Beth, thank you very much for helping us out
this
morning.
Okay, thanks.
That's Beth Dinan, reporter for Seacoast Online. Again, she's in Portsmouth this morning covering this storm there. With us now on the line is Bill Boynton. He's a spokesperson for the New Hampshire Department of Transportation. Bill, thank you for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. A flash mob snowball fight. I just learned something on the radio.
We try to keep you surprised, Bill. Well, we heard from Beth that it's pretty bad over on the Seacoast. What other parts of the state are you hearing about that have been especially hard hit, Bill?
Well, it got a little slower start in the central and northern parts of the state. I woke up at 4 a.m., looked outside, and I'm like, that's it? But right now in Concord, where I live, it's coming down pretty good, and it's spread pretty much as far north as the White Mountains region. Far northern COAS hasn't really seen much, but we have virtually all of our state crews out and have been for most of the night. Difficult visibility, but certainly great plowing conditions. Very low traffic volumes. People heeded the advice of the governor. Transportation Management Center estimates less than 5% of the normal Tuesday morning traffic. So the plow trucks have the roads to themselves. It's a dry, cold-type condition, so the snow is just easy to plow. As Beth mentioned, the blowing aspect is going to be an ongoing problem where it just continues to fill in after the plow trucks go by. And even after the snow stops on Wednesday. We'll have to keep an eye on that probably for the next several hours beyond that.
Sure. So hardly anybody else on the roads besides the plow trucks then.
That's right. And, of course, Massachusetts, a very restrictive travel situation down there, a lot of school closures. So this is a much better situation for our trucks than some of those mixed precipitation, ice storm, icy condition situations where there's a lot of incidents and difficult getting to certain locations. They're out there. The longevity of it is going to be a challenge in terms of fatigue, but they've experienced these types of long storms before.
Sure. Well, in mentioning the statewide travel ban, Massachusetts, as you said, had one starting at midnight. Connecticut, we just heard, took theirs off. New Hampshire doesn't do this, do they, Bill, sort of travel
bans? We really
don't.
And occasionally, state police will close a section of road if there's an incident, but we have no history of doing that. Of course, we had no history of closing the toll facilities either until midnight last night, but the decision was made in consultation with the governor regarding the safety of our Turnpike's employees that we closed the toll facilities to all transactions, both Easy Pass and cash, from midnight last night until midnight tonight.
Well, and especially if you've only got 5% of the regular traffic,
you're
not going to make that much money on the tolls. Anyway, just remind us very quickly, if you could, Bill, please. Sometimes people get frustrated because a certain road isn't well plowed. They blame DOT. Remind us of the breakdown of road responsibility between your agency and local governments.
Sure. We're responsible for about 4,600 miles of state highway. That translates to over 9,000 lane miles. We have a winter snow and ice policy that's based on a snowfall rate of no more than an inch an hour. So when you're getting 1 to 3 inches like now, there is no way we can keep up with that. We also have a tiered practice in which not all roads are treated the same. Our type 1A roadway is the interstate and the divided highway. That gets the most frequent attention, any road with over 15,000 average daily traffic. So we guarantee, under our snow and ice policy, a maximum accumulation of 3 inches and a plowing frequency of an hour and a half. So it's going to still take that plow truck an hour and a half to get back to that same location. But you go down the list, and then you get to a secondary road with low salt, and it could be 2.5 hours before we get back to that location. So,
wow.
When people say they haven't seen a plow truck, there may be a good reason for that. It may be on the other end of the run, so to speak. We have over 90 patrol facilities across the state that are responsible for various sections of road, and all of these plow crews take great pride in the regions they're responsible for.
And if people say, I haven't seen a plow in, you know, X amount of time, it may also be because they live on a major local road that you're not responsible for.
That's right. And in some situations, like Concord, for example, they have what they call urban compacts, where the state road may be also Loudoun Road, but the city maintains that section of state road.
Okay, well, I'm guessing final advice, Bill, for folks listening is just stay home.
Well, I guess I would quote the headline in the Concord Monitor today, and that's hunker down. and most people, I guess, have decided to do that and just enjoy the weather out the window.
Yeah, and take your car off the road. As we heard from Beth, some people in Portsmouth parked overnight in the street.
Well, that's not a good idea either. And I live in a complex where they had to cone everything off to make sure people didn't park in the street. So, the plow drivers need their space to do their work.
Okay. Bill, thank you very much. I know you're busy. I'll let you go.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. That's Bill Boynton again. He's a spokesperson for the New Hampshire Department of Transportation. You can join us with your questions and thoughts, the experiences that you're having with the storm, the impacts you see around you, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. With us now on the line is Michael Todd. He's Public Information Officer for New Hampshire's Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. And Michael Todd, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Laura.
Well, what have you seen broadly across the state, Michael? What's the latest?
Well, we're still in the throes of this storm, and we're expecting 1 to 2 feet of snow. That'll taper off towards the afternoon today, but it should continue snowing through Wednesday. Right now we're seeing the high winds that bring that dangerous whiteout condition that most emergency responders and state officials have been talking about. You know, we really want to emphasize that stay put. Do not go out in this storm. And if you have to go out, make sure you're staying on main roads. Let someone know your destination, arrival, time, and route. And pack an emergency kit, even if it's impromptu. You know, if you don't think to yourself, hey, I don't have my emergency kit ready already, it doesn't matter. get some water, some food, some blankets, and make sure you have those in your car with you.
An emergency kit in your car, just in case you happen to get stuck in a snowdrift.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, we're not expecting a lot of power outages. We only have about 25 right now, and you know, if you're the one without power, it's a big deal. So certainly we're not minimizing that. But if you know, keep your heat at 70, prepare for the possibility of an outage, and keep your phones and other devices charging now, and leave them charging, because if the power goes out, those devices can be key to your safety.
Yeah, we were madly charging everything in our house last night, so I hear you. Well, what are your greatest concerns, Michael, when you are facing a huge storm like this across the state?
Well, the biggest concern right now is people traveling on the roads. You know, the message has gone out over and over and over again, and we realize that, you know, some travel is going to be required. But if you do that, you know, safety is paramount. Remember that. Make smart decisions now to keep this storm from becoming a tragedy, you know, and just use your common sense. Drive slowly. Don't change lanes unless absolutely necessary. And again, if you can stay put, do so. Our other concern is with these high winds, individuals, as the snow lightens up, individuals are going to go out and start clearing. And, you know, don't overexert yourself. Make sure you're dressed in layers. Make sure you don't have exposed skin because you can get frostbite. You know, have to be concerned about hypothermia as well. So it's really important that people keep themselves, you know, apprise themselves of the situation and dress and act appropriately.
Yeah, you said 1 to 2 feet through Wednesday. Does that mean through Wednesday, you know, 3, 4 in the morning, or through Wednesday all day?
At this time, it's you know, it's difficult to say exactly. Other than that, it'll start to taper off this afternoon, but it should continue snowing into the night and into Wednesday.
And you mentioned bundle up, don't get frostbite. When I was out on my way in this morning, and I did not drive, I want to let you know I was off the roads. It didn't seem that cold. Is the forecast for it to get a lot colder, Michael?
Well, it's. You know, the temperatures are going to be in the teens and all the way in the single digits as you get closer to the coast. But it's the wind chill factor. You know, yes, you know, teens, and we're hardy, you know, in New Hampshire, and we know how to dress for the weather. But don't be misled. You know, we're looking at anywhere between 15 to 55 mile per hour wind gusts, and that can you know, lower the temperature significantly.
Okay, Michael, thank you very much. I'll let you get back to work.
Okay, thank you very much, Laura.
Bye bye. That's Michael Todd, Public Information Officer for the Department of Homeland Security. More storm coverage in just a moment. Stay with us.
This is NHPR. It's 9:19. Good morning. New Hampshire weather blizzard warning remains in effect in Rockingham, Stratford, and eastern Hillsborough counties, with winter storm warnings in effect for the rest of the state till 4 o'clock tomorrow morning. We also have a coastal flood warning in effect till 6 this evening. Snow for today will be heavy at times, windy, gusts up to 50 miles per hour, especially along the coast, causing blowing and drifting snow. Highs mid-teens, but wind chills below zero. Total snow accumulations by Wednesday morning, 18 to 25 inches in southeastern and southern parts of the state. Central areas of the state and the upper valley will see accumulations from 10 to 18 inches. North country will have total accumulations 6 to 12 inches. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners. M from Auto Fair Automotive Group, offering Volkswagen, Honda, Nissan, Hyundai, and Ford in multiple locations throughout New Hampshire and Massachusetts. Auto Fair makes it happen. AutoFair.com. And the New Hampshire Humanities Council accepting nominations for their 40 over 40 awards through January 31st. Information on nominating your humanities hero at nhhc.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're bringing you a two-part show. First, the impact of this enormous storm we're seeing here in New England. And in a few moments, we'll find out more about some exciting new research on bats, their incredible immune systems, what this might tell us about treating human diseases. But we're going to stay with the weather for just another moment or two. Martin Murray is with us now on the line, spokesman for Public Service of New Hampshire. Martin, thanks for taking time out. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Good morning, Laura.
Well, as we heard earlier, not very many outages reported already. What are you hearing?
You know, our system is holding up very well. We had a quiet night. As of right now, as you and I speak, we have one outage in Francistown. It's impacting about two dozen customers. Crews are on scene, and they tell me that they expect to have power restored about 10:30. So it has been quiet. I attribute that to the wind. you know, our system can handle winds in the 30 to 35 mile per hour zone with usually no problem, and I think that's the case today. What's interesting, Laura, is to see what's happening south of Boston on the South Shore and the Cape and the Islands. NSTAR is reporting almost 13,000 customers without power there. So that's pretty significant, and I would say that what we'll find is that the winds are just of much greater intensity there. If they stay where they are here, hopefully we'll be in good shape, but we're ready to respond if they do pick up and we do have more outages.
Yeah, it is interesting to hear you talk about that 35-mile-an-hour standard. We heard just a minute ago, you probably heard this, Martin, Michael Todd said winds in some instances could get up to 55 miles an hour, so that's a concern.
Yeah, there'll be some severe gusts, especially on the seacoast, and that can cause, Laura, you know, a tree or a branch or a limb to come down, something loosened along Thanksgiving week, perhaps, to come down and hit some equipment. So we have to be on alert for that. We have a lot of boots on the ground. We have over 275 PSNH and contract line workers in place right now. We actually have 200 other line workers on the way, struggling through the snow to get here to help us. They're expected tomorrow. Hopefully, we won't need them.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. How hard has it been for your crews to get around? I mean, the roads need to be cleared so they can get where they need to go.
Yeah, it's interesting, Laura. Most people I've spoken to said that there was little problem getting to work today early. It's a little tougher right now, and they're expecting it to get worse later. So luckily, we got everyone where they needed to be very early this morning. They're in place. But as they go out to respond to calls, it's going to be a little tougher sledding.
Well, yeah, and with the Thanksgiving storm, you know, utility people like you, Martin, talked a lot about the difficulty of mashed potato snow, heavy and clumpy, and that brought a lot of trees and power lines down. What's this snow like, Martin?
No problem at all. Boy, I went out today to brush off my car, and I only had to brush off one half because the snow simply wasn't sticking to the car except where the wind had just blasted against one side of the car. So it's very interesting. It's a unique consistency. It's really like ice crystals. I think if you're a downhill or Nordic skier, you're going to have a blast later this week once the snow dies down, the wind dies down, because it's just wonderful powdery snow, as Bill Boynton mentioned. But it's really the winds that are our concern. So we're hoping that they just stay about where they are, and they lessen after the next 8 to 10 hours or so. And if they do, we'll be in good shape.
Okay, we'll keep our fingers crossed. Martin Murray, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Martin Murray, spokesman for Public Service of New Hampshire. Stay with NHPR all day for more coverage of this storm and its impacts. And we'll be back with more information tomorrow on The Exchange. Now, though, we turn to another subject that's confounded biologists for years. Why bats in the eastern U.S. are dying out so severely from something called white nose syndrome, and why their otherwise super immune systems aren't helping them with white nose. And by the way, although many people think bats are creepy, those who study them like to point out their benefit to humankind due to their voracious appetite for insects. One leading bat scientist estimates that for every 1 million bats which die out prematurely from white nose, almost 700 tons of insects go uneaten every summer. So with that in mind, we are talking now with Kevin Olival. He's a senior research scientist and bat expert with Eco Health Alliance. And Kevin, thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
Well, so here's the confusing part, Kevin. At the same time, we hear about bats being decimated by this fungus, and we've been talking about this for a couple years here in New England. There is new research on the amazing immune systems bats have when it comes to other illnesses. So what are we learning right now about bats' stellar ability to ward off other diseases that other mammals, including humans, fall prey to?
Sure. Yeah, it's a fascinating area. There really is. Bat immunology is a very emerging field. And so a lot of people are interested in what allows these animals. And by the way, bats are this extremely diverse group, over 1,200 species of bats in the world, about 20% of all the mammals in the world. And so bats as a group tend to carry a fairly large number of viruses that we know of, including things like SARS. Ebola virus is likely linked to bats. and a number of other viruses that, of course, kill humans but don't kill the bats. And this relationship we see is actually fairly typical with a number of what we call wildlife disease reservoirs. So these are the natural hosts that carry that disease. And so bats, like some rodents also, with Hansa viruses and other viruses that people can die from, carry these viruses but don't get sick. But there's been a lot of really interesting research on bats, particularly that are saying, well, are bats really more special than other mammals? And if you think about bats, the one thing that really differentiates them from all other mammals is that they fly.
Right.
So they're the only group of mammals capable of self-powered flight. And because of that, there are some really interesting theories and hypotheses that link this idea of flight with some how their immune system may be different. So when bats wake up in the evening time and they go out to go forage and go find insects and fly around, they ramp up their basal metabolic rate. So they essentially start flapping their wings, their whole body heats up. And so some of our colleagues have this theory that basically every night they have a big fever. And fever is a natural response to help your body deal with pathogens and viruses. You know, when you get the flu, you get a fever, well, that's a way of helping to knock down those virus particles. And so maybe bats are just going through this sort of regular fever every night. And on top of that, they seem to have maybe some ways to help repair the damage that comes with that big boost in your metabolic rate. These little molecules called free radicals that will destroy your cells and kind of link the chain reactions.
Right, link to the aging process. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's some ideas that maybe bats have a better response to deal with those free radicals than some of their hosts.
Well,
so it's an intriguing area, for sure.
Yeah, and lots to untangle here. And Jeff Foster is also with us. He's an assistant professor of genetics at UNH. His research focus includes bats and white nose syndrome. And Jeff Foster, welcome to you too. Thanks for your time.
Hi, Laura. Thank you.
Well, and as you heard, Kevin's been telling us about just the amazing immune system that bats have, and we'll get into that in a minute. But here's the big question that I had looking at the information. If bats, you know, don't get Ebola, they don't get SARS, they don't get cancer, they live much, much longer than mammals similar to them in size, why are they so devastated by white nose syndrome, Jeff? Why don't their superstellar immune systems help them fight white nose?
Yeah, so I'd say with the blizzard raging outside, it really is remarkable to think that our bats of the region are hunkered down in these caves, hibernating and waiting out the winter. And so what they typically do is they enter into hibernation, and their immune systems are largely on a low simmer or off. And so in many ways, they're not prepared for any pathogen that may be able to attack them in the winter. And in fact, many pathogens, nearly all pathogens, have to have fairly warm temperatures to enable to survive. One exception is the tongue-twisting fungus that causes white nose syndrome called Pseudogymnoascus destructans. And so, as you talked about before, it has caused the deaths of over 6 million bats since it was first observed in New York State in 2006. And so what this fungus is able to do is able to attack the bats in midwinter when their immune systems are most vulnerable because they're essentially turned off.
I see. So, and I have read about how it attacks them during hibernation, wakes them up basically when they shouldn't be woken up, and then they lose their fat stores. Is that
yes,
right, Jeff?
That's exactly right. And so they have a fairly generous amount of fat in their bodies that enables them to get through the winter. But what's happening now is that the fungus is disturbing the bats so much, the fungus is actually growing into the skin of the bats, causing them to wake up and go through their fat reserves entirely before the end of the winter.
And Kevin, I want to bring you on this in on this as well, but so, Jeff, just as we talk about the particular problem with white nose is it attacks the bats during the wintertime when they should be sleeping, basically. If they were hit with white nose syndrome in the summertime, would they be as affected or would they be able to shake it off?
So it turns out that they're able to completely fight off the fungus in the summer. In fact, when we look for the fungus in the summer, by the end of the summer, there's no detectable amounts of the fungus on any bats that we look at.
Wow. Kevin, jump in on here. I'd love to hear what you're learning about white nose and why the bat's incredible immune system doesn't seem to help them with this in the wintertime.
Yeah, I think Jeff explained it really well that, you know, it's you're hitting them when they're down, right, when their immune system's on this low simmer.
Right.
But compounded with that, interestingly, it's kind of this double whammy because the fungus, Pseudogymnosus instructions, only grows really well in the cold temperatures. So, you know, there have been laboratory studies where we looked at different temperatures and the growth curves for this fungus, and it seems to just thrive and multiply actually during those colder hibernation temperatures.
And
so it's sort of, you know, in the summer it's not growing quite well, but in the winter when it's growing best and when the immune systems of the bats are sort of at the lowest is where this pathogen really has its prime opportunity.
So even though they have these incredible immune systems, Kevin, the immune system is down in the wintertime, and that's why they fall prey to white nose.
Yeah, that's the theory. And, you know, I think the jury is still a little bit out on exactly how special their immune systems are, bats as a whole. But clearly, they are important reservoirs for a number of these emerging diseases that affect humans, and that's very clear. And so really all these studies that are delving into the bat immune system are going to be critical over the next 5 or 10 years.
Well, I definitely want to ask both of you guys about that. Let me also invite our listeners, though, to join us. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Again, today in The Exchange, it's a two-part show. We talked earlier about the impact of this huge storm we're seeing in New England, and NHPR will be following that all day, of course, for you. But right now, we're looking at some exciting new research about bats and their immune systems, what this might teach us about human disease, also why bats have been having so much trouble with something called white nose syndrome. Let's hear from you. Your questions and comments are welcome at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And before we get to, guys, both of you, the idea that bats' immune systems can maybe help us combat diseases that affect human beings. Jeff, I know you like to remind people that even though they may think bats are creepy, they have a huge ecological and economic impact on us here in the Granite State and in New England.
Yeah, so it's been recently estimated that bats provide what we call ecosystem services, and so things that we don't normally think about but are really important to our everyday lives. And the biggest thing is that they provide they're a major insectivore, and so they eat a lot of our insect pests. And so they're out there flying around. Many people are certainly familiar in New Hampshire with mosquitoes. They do eat tons and tons of mosquitoes a year, but they also eat major pests of agriculture and of our forests as well. And so they're out there flying and eating the moss that we're so worried about defoliating various plants that we value.
So all the nasty bugs and insects that are carrying diseases and hurting crops, bats are chomping on those.
They are, and the estimated amounts are in the billions of dollars a year that bats save to our economy. And so they provide a really useful and valuable benefit.
Wow, a billions of dollars. Do you think people, Kevin, appreciate the economic impact of something that they really don't want flying around their house?
I don't think they do. You know, I think a lot of people just really aren't aware of how valuable bats are. And when you put a dollar value on that, it really gets people's attention, right? And that, you know, if we didn't have bats around, how many billions or millions and millions of dollars would we have to use on pesticides to spray our corn crops in the Midwest? Because all the moths that eat those corn crops are still around. So, yeah, I think when you start to put dollar values on it, it gets people's attention. And I think it's a great argument. I'll just add one thing. There's also a large group of bats that feed on fruit and also pollen and nectar. And so there's this whole other group of bats, especially in the tropics, that provide another ecosystem service, which is essentially pollinating crops and dispersing seeds throughout the forest. So they help with forest regeneration and even crops, which for some are important, like tequila. Tequila is primarily a bat-pollinated cactus, which is an interesting little fact.
Wow. So if you like margaritas, support bat research.
That's right.
That is, I did not know that, Kevin. You learn something new every day. So what about, Kevin, droppings? You mentioned, some feed off of fruits, and so they're pollinating there, and some eat insects, which we all know about the benefits of that. But birds, we often hear, are helpful because of their droppings. What about bats?
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah, bats, same thing, especially for the fruit-eating bats when they poop as they're flying around, they're spreading seeds, so they're helping regenerate these plants. And, of course, bat guano from insect-feeding bats is used in many countries as fertilizer for crops. So people go into caves, harvest the guano, and put that on their food crops.
All right, gentlemen, we've got some listeners who want to join our conversation. Again, your questions and comments about what's happening with the bats in our part of the country. Also, new research on bats' immune systems. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And let's go first to Concord, where Doreen's on the line. Hi, Doreen. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Thank you for taking my call. Hi. In the 80s, I lived in southeastern Massachusetts on Mount Hope Bay, and I knew the late anthropologist and veterinarian Elizabeth Atwood from Tufts. And we had a conversation one time about the spraying that was going on because of equine encephalitis outbreak, and she noticed a dramatic effect on the bat population after that spraying. And I'm wondering if since then there's been any research on the effects of that spraying on bats, and if the spraying that we're doing now might have be supporting some of the diseases that we're seeing in bats.
Wow, Doreen, great question. Kevin, Jeff, can you answer that one? The spraying we do for insects, is that hurting bats?
Or Kevin, not any research that I'm familiar with, but certainly aquatic insects, of which mosquitoes would be, are a big part of bat diets. It all depends on exactly where you're finding the bats, and so. But aquatic insects, and so insects that are emerging from our waterways, are a big part of bat diets in particular areas, and they would definitely be affected by spraying in those areas.
Okay, thank you for the question, Doreen. We'll take more of your questions and comments in just a moment. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Keep it right here.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, President Obama proposes to greatly expand wilderness protections in Alaska. Then how political corruption threatens global security. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
This morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. New Hampshire weather blizzard warnings remain in effect in Rockingham, Stratford, and eastern Hillsborough counties, with winter storm warnings in effect for the rest of the state till 4 tomorrow morning. Also, a coastal flood warning in effect till 6 this evening. Snow today will be heavy at times. Windy gusts up to 50 miles per hour, especially along the coast, causing blowing and drifting snow. Highs mid-teens, but wind chills below zero. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from the H&H Foundation, making grants to create healthy places where children can walk, play, and access healthy food in their own community. More information at hnhfoundation.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Stay with NHPR all day for information about the storm that's hitting us here in New England. We talked about that earlier in the hour on The Exchange, and we'll give you an update in about 20 minutes. Right now, though, we're finding out more about some exciting new research about bats, their incredible immune systems, what this might teach us about human disease. We've also, though, been talking about the struggles of bats in this part of the country, still decimated by white nose syndrome. We have two researchers with us, Jeff Foster, an assistant professor of genetics at UNH, and Kevin Olival, senior research scientist and bat expert with Eco Health Alliance. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. And Josh joins us from Plymouth. Hi, Josh. You're on the exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
Yeah, no, I just had a question. I was wondering if environmental changes or human activities impact this fungus on the bats, or if it's something that might have occurred anyways, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a great question. Thank you very much, Josh. All right, so Jeff, do you want to take that one? Climate change, disruptions in habitat, human activity causing white-nose syndrome among bats.
Yeah, it's an unanswered question right now, but certainly, so we know that the fungus is abundant throughout Eurasia, well, particularly in Europe, and so just about every place our colleagues have looked for the fungus, they've found it on bats hibernating throughout Europe. And there's some initial suggestions that it goes as far east and into China. And so it's certainly a common fungus of bats throughout Europe, and the fungus does not kill them there. And so it appears that the bats there have evolved a resistance to the fungus itself. And we also can look at the genetics of the fungus there, and it's really, really diverse fungus throughout Europe, strongly suggesting that the fungus has been there for thousands of years, and that's our best guess.
Wow. So, Jeff, let me just jump in, if I could, to clarify. So European bats are getting white nose, too, but they're not dying from it?
Right. And so you can go out into European caves. You'll see the telltale kind of fungal, white fungal growth on their faces and on their wings, but it's not killing the bats there.
Wow, Kevin, what do you pull out of that? That's really interesting.
Yeah, that is the story. And the interesting thing, I think the listener's question was right on in that, what are we doing to the environment? And so white nose syndrome is an example of an introduced disease. I mean, based on the evidence that Jeff just explained, we're everywhere we look in Europe, we found it. We know that it just arrived in the U.S. around 2006. And so this was brought over by people. And so, you know, people not cleaning their gear, maybe going into caves in Europe and bringing this back. We don't know who did it. It was just maybe some tourist, maybe some, could have been anybody. But it most likely was a human being who brought the fungus to the United States. And so I think this is a general trend, something we're very interested in at EcoHealth, is this idea of how do human impact on the environment, different things that we're doing to increasing our travel and trade and globalization, the deforestation and hunting of animals, how do all these things link in with emerging diseases, both that affect the wildlife, but also that affect humans.
So more often than not,
what we're seeing is, you know, humans are doing things to the environment that are actually causing us to get exposed to these new diseases like Ebola virus or SARS virus. And it's this unnatural phenomena that we're creating that's really allowing these diseases to jump from the wildlife population into humans.
Can we conclude, Kevin, then, that European bats have just developed a resistance to this because they've been dealing with it longer, and that American bats haven't developed that resistance yet?
I think that's a valid theory, yeah. I think that, you know, they've been exposed to it for a long time. And I think Jeff probably, I know Jeff's done some more research on this, but he might want to comment more. But absolutely, this idea of genetically some sort of immunity that is likely genetic and passed on, these bats in Europe may have, that the North American bats do not yet have that resistance.
Well, here's an email from Ellen in Manchester who says, bats have been around for a very long time. Have there ever been these large die-offs from disease in the past? And Ellen says, why is this happening now? So, Jeff, why don't you take that one?
Sure. That is definitely something we're interested in. And so if, for example, as we hypothesize that bats in Europe have evolved a resistance, there may have been large die-offs in the past in Europe. And so we can, this is something we're certainly interested in pursuing in the future, is look at bat populations in Europe and see if we can genetically detect if there's been any kind of signal that there have been major die-offs. And you can also try to look in the fossil record, particularly kind of going through sediments of caves, to see if there are any major detections of any major die-off events. And so those two things are kind of future planned projects that would shed some light, hopefully, on the likelihood that there were major die-offs in the past. That would be in Europe. There has been no known major die-offs of bats in North America. And so that's what makes this fungus so unusual. And, you know, we've been talking about how bats really have these amazing immune systems, and it's only when they are faced with a fungus that really is able to exploit kind of the weakness of their immune system is it able to have such a big effect.
Well, Ellen, thanks for that email. And you can email us, too, at exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Suzanne's in Kittery. Hi, Suzanne. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
About 2 years ago, my mother was renting an apartment in Concord, and in the space of about 3 months, 2 months, at least three occasions, bats were in the house, and we were trying to get rid of them. How do you? We fixed the chimney, but before that, how when they're flying around, how do you get them out? We opened the windows, and we were swatting at them, and a veterinarian told us don't touch them because they're rabid. And what do you do with bats in the house?
Yeah, and yet you know they're useful, so you maybe don't want to kill them, Suzanne,
right,
but you definitely
right.
don't want them flying around. I hear you. Thank you so much for the call. Kevin, I'm guessing a lot of listeners have that question. Okay, I appreciate what the bats do
sure.
for the environment and the ecosystem and so forth, but I really don't want it in my house.
Yeah, it's pretty common to get a wayward bat that, you know, finds his way in and he might get stuck in the house. And they're not always rabid, but that is a concern. And so, you know, more often than not, they're not going to have rabies. It's a very low percentage of bats that have rabies, I think less than 1%. And so, you know, there is always the risk there. So we always suggest that, no, do not handle the bat, especially with your bare hands. You know, we recommend basically you would contact your local wildlife authority or your local animal authority to help you out with that situation.
Although usually it happens in the middle of the night.
Yeah, well, that is a problem. I mean,
sounds, you know, good in theory,
ways,
but
I think opening the windows and trying to, you know, sort of usher the bat out of the window is a good way to go about, as the listener was suggesting.
Well,
again, you don't want to grab the animal with your bare hand just in case you do happen to get bit.
If you're my parents, you may call me. And so they recently had a big brown bat. They live in Sunapee, New Hampshire.
Uh-huh.
And they had a big brown bat in their house. And I have been rabies vaccinated, and so I ushered it outside.
Well, but
there you go. Get to know a bat biologist. That's
yeah, Jeff, you can start a little side business there, right?
Yeah.
But Suzanne, I appreciate the call. And, you know, she mentioned being afraid that bats are rabid, and I'm sure many people have that concern, Jeff. And also for you, Jeff, Kevin mentioned earlier, okay, bats are reservoirs, as biologists put it, for diseases like SARS, like Ebola. I mean, who wants to go near these things if they've got Ebola?
Yeah, and so I think it's a key point that if you are faced with that type of situation, you really call in a professional who can help you with it. And so there are lots of licensed wildlife professionals who can best of all exclude bats. You don't want to do it while they have their pups, and so you have to make sure that you don't do that. But at those times of the year where you can really go in and exclude bats from coming into your house, and so there's various ways that you can seal off kind of the cracks and crevices of your house to prevent them from coming in the first place.
Well, and about that idea, Jeff, that bats are reservoirs for viruses, even though they, with these incredible immune systems, what are the implications for the study of diseases that affect humans, given what we know about how great the bats are at warding off disease?
Yeah, Kevin, maybe you want to field that since it's his expertise.
That's Kevin's field. Okay,
sure.
Go ahead, Kevin.
Sure. You know, bats do, so we are finding a large number of these viruses all around the world. And so I guess I'll first caution that it's not to say, we're not saying that any bats in North America might carry Ebola virus. So these are, you know, some of the bats in Africa where Ebola outbreaks have occurred, there's evidence that they carry Ebola and Ebola-like viruses. And so there's, you know, these sort of geographic patterns to disease, just like there are geographic patterns to human culture and everything else. Where, you know, certain diseases are found in certain pockets in wildlife all around the world. And so you know, we have a number of large studies where we're looking in not only bats, but bats, rodents, primates, shrews, you know, all sorts of mammals around the world, and looking at all the viruses they may carry. And so there is this huge diversity of viruses in the natural world, I would say. And I think really the key in linking these things and linking together conservation and all these new studies on disease is understanding what are the real factors that are causing diseases to jump into people. You know, it's not just that they're out there, that these diseases are in the natural wildlife populations. It's we're doing something to the environment, or somehow we're coming into contact with these animals that we weren't in contact with before. And so really trying to tease out those precise human behaviors and those precise ecological factors that are causing diseases to jump. And so that's really, I think, the big concern and the big future push that we need to be working towards.
Let's take another call. This is Hector in Wolfboro. Hi, Hector. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call from sunny Wolfboro. I understand that some species of bats migrate. If they're diseased, do they possibly spread it to other bats in other areas?
Thanks for the call, Hector. Do you want to comment on that, Jeff?
Sure. That's a great question, and it's the major reason why we think the fungus has spread so rapidly across North America. So it was initially detected in near Albany, New York in 2006, and since then has likely killed more than 6 million bats and has spread to 25 states and 5 or 6 Canadian provinces. And so it's really spread very quickly. And it's spread so fast, and our genetic signatures that we're looking at strongly suggest that bats are moving it indeed long, long distances on the order of hundreds of miles. And so definitely their migration patterns and just simply their movement patterns throughout the year are undeniably spreading the fungus long distances and has really allowed it to spread all the way from New York up into the Maritimes in Canada and all the way west to west of the Mississippi to states such as, you know, Iowa, Missouri, and Arkansas.
You know, Jeff, one of you mentioned that there are many, many species of bats. Is white-nose syndrome affecting, you know, one species in particular or several different species or all species?
So it's affecting primarily our 6 species of bats, and they're the species of bats that are living in caves primarily in the eastern United States. And so, it's only a handful of species, but it's really, really impacting those species. And so we'll have declines at a particular cave of 99%. And so 99% of the bats that were there are no longer at a particular hibernating place. And so those are major, major decimations of populations.
Well, and here's another email from David in Amherst. He says, is it helpful to support bat survival to set up a bat house outside my house or not? David says, if so, any guidelines on building them? Glad you emailed, David, because, Kevin, at my old house, we had a bat house outside, and we never saw bats in them. They came into our house a couple times, but we peeked in the bat house a bunch of times and never saw anything in there. So they seem to like our house better than the bat house. So, David, thank you.
That's where the specs and where you put them and how you build them, I think, comes into handy. And there are lots of great resources on the Internet. I believe, you know, Bat Conservation International will have some guidelines on that. But there are – absolutely you should build a bat house. I think every – you know, providing more habitat is better than, as habitat around the world is diminishing, the more that we can do to help is definitely worthwhile. And so bat houses are great. Bats will use them. Not always, but sometimes, you know, bats will find them and use them. And it's great to provide that habitat for them.
Maybe they didn't like the wallpaper that we put up. I'm not really sure why they didn't go in there. So, gentlemen, so much more that we could talk about. But, Kevin, just to finish off with you, if I could. So what more do you think we need to know? What would you love to just discover, like, right now about bats that you don't know now?
Oh, wow. Great question. We started off talking about the immune system of bats. And so I think, you know, that really is a ripe area for exploration. I think you know, the work that Jeff is doing with white nose syndrome and the research community, the more we know about the immune system and its link with white nose will help us understand that problem as well. You know, I think bats are fascinating and have been an understudied group for a long time. They're sort of these nocturnal, cryptic creatures that, you know, a very small community of researchers was interested, say, 20, 30 years ago. Now there's growing interest because of some of these links with white nose and with emerging diseases. But I think there's so much more for us to learn, and I think it's just a great – I love studying bats, and I think it's a great field.
Jeff, how about you, real quick?
Yeah, I'm definitely interested in – there is a glimmer of hope here, particularly for bats in the Northeast. And so we have some kind of pockets of individuals that may be resistant to the disease. We don't know that for sure, but investigating both the genetics and environmental factors that may be enabling these pockets of survivors to persist and maybe be the seeds of our future bat populations is certainly an interesting area of research.
All right. Well, Jeff, thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate it. We'll call you the next time there's a bat in the house.
Alrighty.
That's Jeff Foster, Assistant Professor of Genetics at UNH. You too, Kevin Olival, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Laura. Pleasure.
Kevin Olival, Senior Research Scientist and Bat Expert with EcoHealth Alliance. The Exchange is a production of NHPR, and stay with NHPR all day. We'll be covering the storm, how it's affecting New Hampshire and New England. We'll have a little bit more information for you tomorrow on The Exchange, but NHPR will be on this story all day long, so keep it right here. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search iTunes for NHPR Exchange.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, Americans are feeling testy about standardized tests. You hear a lot of grumbling these days that students and teachers are overwhelmed by testing regimes aimed at keeping districts accountable. We'll talk with an author who says there are better ways to track how kids and educators are doing. We'll find out more and keep an eye on the impacts of this week's storm. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
This is NHPR with the Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock. New Hampshire weather blizzard warnings remain in effect in Rockingham, Stratford, and eastern Hillsborough counties, with winter storm warnings in effect for the rest of the state till 4 o'clock tomorrow morning. Also, coastal flood warnings in effect till 6 this evening. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Vintage Kitchens of Concord, professional kitchen design that creatively meets the owner's needs while complementing the home's architectural features. VintageKitchens.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. The U.S. Department of Interior is asking Congress to set aside many additional millions of acres within the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge as wilderness. A wilderness designation prohibits all mining, drilling, roads, vehicles, and permanent structures. President Obama says the measure is needed, quote, to make sure that this amazing wonder is preserved for future generations. But Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski called the plan as a stunning attack on Alaska's economic prospects. Debate over additional wilderness protections in the Arctic National Refuge. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The National Weather Service has issued blizzard warnings for the Northeast along the Atlantic coast. Wind gusts have been measured at 65 miles per hour. Snowfall is being measured in feet. Sean Corcoran is with member station WCAI on Cape Cod, Massachusetts, where he says officials are keeping an eye out for damage.
We're watching the winds. We'll see how things go. We're worried about coastal flooding. We're worried about erosion. We have towns here which can significantly change their coastlines when we have these high seas. And this storm is really about its duration. It's going to stay for a few hours. It could be here all day long, just pounding the coast.
The storm is pulling away from more southerly states. Travel bans have been lifted in New Jersey, the area around New York City, and in parts of Connecticut. But hundreds of airline flights remain canceled, so is Amtrak's passenger rail service north of New York City. President Obama has arrived in Saudi Arabia to pay U.S. respects on the death of Saudi King Abdullah. The king died last week at the age of 90. Obama has just completed a trip to India, where he ended by speaking to an audience in New Delhi. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports he urged Indians to act on behalf of women and against religious bigotry.
A headline on the president's final day in India read, "A parade of friendship," and so it was. But President Obama also waded into